So I hit the lottery in my profession. It was like, I think, midnight or just before midnight when they probably passed this bill. I don't remember the exact time, but I remember getting a call from some of my legislative friends that you have $60 million. Now, you know, show us the beef, so to speak. So that was pretty exciting after 4 years of a decimated public health budget, particularly in health promotion. I started at the department 5.5 years ago in the Bureau of Community Health and Prevention, and the health promotion budget, I think at the time, was about $16 million, and very quickly in a few years it got down to about $3 million, where it has stood ever since. So clearly we needed some serious help in prevention to address chronic diseases. So this was an amazing opportunity. Presenter disclosure, okay. I did not get any money for anything. So we had this huge task, but the good news was the work we had done, as Maddie referenced, in Mass in Motion, had already given us a foundation for understanding how we could really take a policy, systems, and built environment approach to change the conditions where people lived. And this was focused on obesity, healthy eating, and active living. But over time, the success of that allowed us to get 2 community transformation grants from the CDC, which allowed us to start thinking about chronic disease prevention and control, and linking community care to clinical care. And so we thought we had a really good basis for thinking through this trust. And as Maddie said, I've been in public health a long time, and when we thought this $60 million was going to be passed, a lot of people were just seeing that this would replace some of the dollars that we lost in the budget over 4 years. And clearly we had deliverables that told us we had to do something different, bigger, show impact, and show cost savings. So as folks have said, this is really the dollar amount. We actually had $3 million taken out for another piece of Chapter 224, so we're really dealing with $57 million. I keep trying to figure out how I'll get that $3 million back. But it was prescribed that 75% of this would go to grants to communities, and that 10% would be for worksite wellness and 15% for administrative support. So you might imagine managing $57 million takes some staff time. We've put an enormous amount of time from existing staff to create the framework for this trust. The outcome measures that were written into Chapter 224, that there would be a reduction in prevalence of preventable health conditions, we would reduce costs, and it would try to match what the cost growth targets were for healthcare reform in the state of Massachusetts, trying to align the growth in cost of healthcare to the growth of revenue in the state of Massachusetts, and that we would focus on employee health productivity through workplace-based wellness programs. So how we framed this was we really looked at the evidence, we incorporated advice, we went out and had 4 listening sessions, we also have an advisory board that gave us input, and then we developed our final framework. Part of Chapter 224 in the Prevention and Wellness Trust required that there be a governor-appointed board that advised the commissioner for what the guiding principles would be, and that we would use evidence-based interventions. We were going to target areas that had high incidence of disease and high health care costs, that they had risk factors and diseases that we could reduce that would lead to these cost savings, and that we would, in the language itself, said that we would promote these community and clinical linkages. It outlined who the grants would go to, and that it was a combination of municipalities, community-based organization, healthcare providers of all shapes and sizes, regional planning. And so it was really new partnerships to really address where we were going into the future. And again, maximizing return on investment. And through the end of this, trying to understand how we could link payment reform to sustainable support for this way of doing health promotion and chronic disease prevention. The Wellness and Advisory Board was really specifically laid out of what types of people would be represented, so you can see a wide array of sectors related to public health, from economics, health equity, public health research, representing local boards of health from large cities and towns to small cities and towns, hospitals, insurers, school nurses, community health workers. And so we kind of worked backwards from what we had to achieve to how we could get there. So we did a lot of research, and we looked at all the preventable health conditions, and we examined them by cost trends. And then we looked at the prevalence of these particular conditions. We looked at comorbidities. Part of the language also said that we needed to think about mental health and the role that that plays on chronic disease and health promotion, and that we really needed to think about reducing health disparities. We also tried to identify what would be the optimum population size that we could really get the achievements that we were trying to get. If it's too large, your per-person expenditure is so small, it's hard to have an impact. If it's too large, it's really not a sustainable model. And we selected 13 health conditions that had strong evidence for delivering a return on investment. Here are these 13 conditions that we identified. And then we put together really comprehensive briefs on each of these conditions that identified the risk factors associated with it, where cost savings could be had, what the burden of disease were in different areas of the state, what the geographic distribution of these diseases were, what the health disparities were, and then what other measures do we have through meaningful use and clinical quality. Each person on the advisory board was asked to prioritize these in terms of what conditions they thought we could get to the return on investment that we were looking for. And this is how we rank them. We then had some discussions about this because obesity came up, obviously, number one here, but we didn't feel there was enough evidence to show that in 3 years we could really show cost savings from preventable chronic conditions. And falls came down very low, and I made a pitch at the meeting that this was somewhere that we were also one of the priorities that was discussed by the advisory board, that we get outside of the traditional chronic conditions to show how we could use this for other conditions in healthcare. And so falls kind of fit that it was really in a short term you could have impact on significant costs and morbidity and mortality. We added some things like violence to it. We did have conversations that we should also consider primary prevention in doing all of this. But through all of this ranking and discussions, we came up with four conditions, and I'm going to go through those. But it was pediatric asthma, falls in older adults, tobacco, and high blood pressure. And so this shows you what the prevalence of asthma is across the state, with the darkest blue being where we have the highest prevalence in pediatric asthma. And then this shows you the costs that are associated with the hospital charges, and we're trying to look for preventable hospitalizations in this particular condition, so obviously trending way up over time. We looked at falls and the age-adjusted unintentional fall death rates for all ages, persons 65 and older. You can see that 65 and older, they have significant impact from falls. And then here are the charges that are associated with hospital stays. And this doesn't even talk about what some of the long-term disability impacts are for people that end up chronically disabled after a fall. Prevalence of hypertension in Massachusetts, 2009, again, the darker the color, the higher the prevalence across the state, and again, associated inpatient hospital costs, very significant. The average charge is about $20,000 per hospitalization, and then your total charge in millions is about $80 million in a year. Adult smoking prevalence across Massachusetts in 2009, and again, the dark blues being our highest and going down to yellow being sort of mid-range, despite the fact that we have some of the best reductions in smoking rates in Massachusetts, we still have work to be done. And then here are total smoking, attributable to smoking costs and healthcare expenditures in Massachusetts, $4.3 billion. So somewhere that we certainly could, if you stop smoking, you pretty quickly, we saw that with some of the work of Dr. Tom Land, who was really an amazing evaluator in helping us put all of this together and creating this model, showed in our tobacco prevention and control program when we passed the no smoking indoors law, that in 18 months we had about a 40-plus drop in hospitalizations related to cardiac events. And so we know that we still have room to improve there. This is our model that shows you how we came to what the total population was that we think spending $60 million would get us a return on investment. And our goal has been thinking about, can we spend $60 million and save $60 million? So this is basically a cost-neutral approach to our work, so that going forward we could really create this as a sustainable way of funding prevention and public health and allow us, as Maddie suggested, start moving more towards primary prevention. So about 1.2 million people in Massachusetts, if we targeted with $60 million, we think would be sort of the maximum population, and about 150,000 would be the smallest size population, and that is if the smallest size population, you'd be spending about $500 a person, and the larger size population would be about 50 per person, and that we think the impact is somewhere in the middle of that for our sweet spot. So we're suggesting to the applicants, of which we think there'll be about 6 to 12 of them, that they have to service a geographic area representing about 30,000 to 120,000 population. Again, we had listening sessions across the state. We went to four different places, and we heard what people said about health disparities and thinking about regional differences, and then the value of partnerships, what lessons we've learned over time. Public health typically works in partnerships and different kinds of coalitions. And then suggestions for new health conditions to be considered. And then what the balance between evidence-based and innovation was. Some of our board members were really adamant that we don't only stay in our evidence-based, because the thinking is we've had our evidence-based programs and we haven't moved the needle, so why not let people take an evidence foundation to what they're thinking about and apply it to some new innovative ways of perhaps putting interventions into communities. And then a really clear and comprehensive evaluation, because we know in 3.5 years or so, we have a report to bring to the legislature, and this is real. We're going to really prove that prevention really can make a difference. And so, as part of Mass in Motion and community transformation, we really have been thinking about how to measure community level changes. How do you bring assets, policy systems, and new built environment to a community, measure what that baseline was, what the added assets were, and did people actually use those new assets in a community to improve and change their lifestyle so that they ultimately have a health outcome. And we're down to looking at zip codes and neighborhoods where we can identify what new assets were brought to a community, how many more people used the sidewalks to walk, how many people purchased healthier foods in the grocery stores in those communities, how many corner stores have fruits and vegetables, and then what are the self-reported behaviors and health outcomes of the individuals in those communities as compared to communities that aren't putting those resources together for health promotion. So we also talked about geographic distribution, wanting to make sure that someone in all parts of the state, so we could look at rural, suburban, and urban differences. And I'm happy to say that we got applications from all over the state in every county, from rural to urban. And then we gave real clear plans on how to move to this implementation phase. It's a pretty was a pretty prescriptive RFR, which again is not usual sometimes in public health. And then in the beginning of the requirements is that they needed to identify how they would come to a sustainable program at the end of the 4 years. So the number of funded community, these were the discussion items that we had at the advisory board. What was the ideal number of communities? How do we identify those that were ready for implementation, very similar to the community transformation grant, although they allowed some planning grants. We were really wanting people that were ready to go into implementation, maybe taking some capacity building amongst the partners and how they would work together and who would do what, but that we really wanted them to be ready to go in a short time. Again, we have a very ticking clock that needs to show that we can improve health and save money. And then we were trying to decide if we should let people just pick any out of that list of the health conditions that we identified had evidence-based preventable interventions, or that we would narrow it down. And so as part of the RFR, applications will need to, applicants will show that they have this meaningful community clinical partnership. Partnerships must represent a variety of sectors within the community and clinical settings, and how they will bridge the gap between these settings. We know that the community has a lot of rich resources, and they've never been able to really be closely linked in a formal way with clinical providers. On how to sustain initiatives, policies, and procedures implemented in each organization and community, and how they've been implemented across the organizations, and how they plan for collaboration and seeking other kinds of fund, diversifying their funding. So promoting strong partnerships, each application, again, decided that there had to be a municipality at the table. They could determine which sector within the municipality or multiple sectors. There had to be at least one clinical partner, and there had to be at least one community-based organization. And we were really trying to change the power dynamic in healthcare, which usually is controlled by hospitals and providers, and to really show through budgets and a memorandum of agreement how they will really be equal in addressing health promotion. Again, 6 to 12 awards. The average size in year one will be about $250,000. That will be that capacity building, developing their memorandums of agreement, identifying who will be doing what interventions. They will have to do interventions across all of the conditions and then in all of the three areas that are part of the collaborative. And then $700,000 to $2.1 million to $2.3 million over the next 3 years after that. We really wanted these to be significant grants, not the usual public health grants of $25,000, $50,000. Sometimes a good grant is like $75,000 or $100,000. You think you struck gold, but that we really, to change the outcomes, we really felt that these needed to be significant grants to communities. Again, limiting the service area from 30,000 to 120,000, and we also in the RFR said they could not overlap, so if two applicants in nearby regions were applying for this, they couldn't serve the same community. We wanted to make sure that we could measure the interventions from that particular collaborative and not have any sort of cross-pollination that would be difficult to assess. And so I think in our applications, we have a couple where communities are overlapping, so we'll meet with those applicants if they end up being the top grantees, that they will have to eliminate some of their communities so there isn't overlapping. Each area, every partner can only be in one application. They couldn't be a partner in multiple applications. And then the list of coordinating partners were posted so that people could see. We actually required a letter of intent that was submitted in September, so we kind of had a sense. We had 33 letters of intent submitted. About 29 of them were really actually potential candidates, because four of them were individual organizations that applied. They didn't apply in a collaborative. We decided on the four conditions that I showed you some of the prevalence on: tobacco use, asthma, hypertension, and falls, that they had to do two of these four conditions. Most of them, I'm happy to say, went with four. We were recommending from the department all four, but the advisory board felt that that was a big obligation to put on people who aren't used to working together, and that just defining who would do what where and when would be hard enough for them to do in this time frame. But obviously these folks feel confident because, as I said, most applications came in with all four, and many came in with others. They were allowed to have some optional conditions. It wasn't going to give them any more on their score, but certainly we'd like to see more things impacted. And then again, this underlying looking at vulnerable populations and the comorbidity of mental health written into the bill itself talked about behavioral health and substance abuse services. And I think that's something in the area of chronic disease prevention and control we have less experience with really addressing in a meaningful way, and we're hopeful that we'll start to get some lessons on using some outcomes from these grants. So again, the three areas of promoting these sustainable linkages is the community supports behavioral change to improve health through individual, social, physical environments where people live and work. clinical interventions, linking the clinical environment, really trying to get clinical providers thinking about population health and looking at the population, their particular populations that they serve, and how do they compare to the region that they're in, the state as a whole, in terms of what the prevalence and incidence of diseases are. And then again, the strengthening the community and clinical linkage. The letter of intent came in, as I said, on September 27th, and last Friday we actually got our final RFRs in, and I believe that we got 24 of them in. Four came in late, so we're trying to decide what to do with the late kids. But so we're really excited. They're about three or four hundred pages long, so it is going to be a pretty significant review process. Again, most of them did apply for all four conditions. One of the other exciting pieces of this grant is that we also got a CMS State Innovation Model grant, and we are developing an e-referral system that can link to electronic health records so that providers can make formal community-based referrals to organizations such as WISE and senior centers and VNAs that can link people to exercise and nutritional programs and also to chronic disease self-management programs, make formal proactive referrals similar to our tobacco cessation line, and that they can follow the patients up and provide feedback back into the clinical record. And so practices can then target their resources to those folks who aren't really compliant with some of the prescriptions for health that they're getting. And so here's our timeline. We did get the applications in November. We will be reviewing them through December and making our award notices with a start date of February. So we're pretty excited.
So we're going to open it up for questions and discussion. There is a mic here, so feel free to come on up, or if you have a loud voice, you can yell. I just have one question to start off, because I'm on the first round technical review team, and I was told there would be three applications, it would be 200 pages each, and now I hear it's 300 to 400 pages. So I'm going to have to clear a little more time on my schedule for the review. Yeah, the tall and the short. So I'm very excited to dig into the 1,200 pages, get to review. Please come up.
I'm Gary J. Overman. I have trust envy. When you are going to establish the trust, and I don't know how Massachusetts works, if you have a tobacco settlement fund as well, and if you do, how you are able to let legislators and others know that these things are either separate or they are now together. We have our own separate trust fund for our master settlement money, which is raided all the time. So I'm just curious what your experience might be.
We never had a separate tobacco truck.
We unfortunately never had a special trust for the tobacco. It actually was a part of the general fund, which unfortunately over time got raided. We at one point had about $50 million that they did in the beginning dedicate to tobacco, and over time that got eroded, and I think we're down to maybe about $4 million that we get in the state line item for tobacco. So this is the first really dedicated sort of public health and prevention trust.
I'll invite people who want to ask a question or make a comment, just that you can come up. You don't have to wait. You can come up to the mic, and we'll just go one at a time.
Hi, I'm Wayne Clark from California, and I just want to compliment you on including mental health and comorbid looking at situations. We in California did have a $160 million preventive suicide reducing disparities and improving student mental health campaign. We're in the second year of it. We've already done the RFAs kind of stuff, we have Rand Corporation evaluating. It's exciting to hear of other states doing the same kind of work and trying to get on the prevention side rather than just in the downstream side. So appreciate you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marianne Hyde from Massachusetts. I was wondering if you could just address the reaction of the insurers when you decided the way you wanted to finance this was through an investment. If you could speak to that, that'd be great.
Sure, and I'm going to sort of look at Val as I say this to see if she's shaking or nodding. I think it's fair to say they weren't thrilled about it. They would have loved to see the state appropriate the money or the hospitals put up the money. It was just sort of everyone pointing in a circle. I think we were able to make the case to them that, A, we wanted to be collaborative, and B, we were open to other ideas, and C, we thought they could actually save money if we were successful. I will say that there were some individuals within the health insurance companies who we had relationships with who were helpful to us sort of behind the scenes and giving advice or saying they supported what we were doing. None of the insurance companies came out publicly to either say they supported or didn't support it. I think one important thing to remember, since this was part of a very large payment reform bill, was that in a large bill like that, no individual player is ever going to get everything they want. So some of the legislative leadership who was very supportive were able to work with some of those diverse players to make sure people were getting some of what they wanted and could live with some of the things they didn't love. I think if we had tried to push this as a standalone bill that just said the insurers are going to pay this money to create this trust, it would have been impossible to do. But the insurers got things out of this bill that they liked, and I think important people in the legislature asked them to accept this as part of that package. That's fair to say. And Val, please, if you want to jump up and add to the conversation. Will you go to the mic, just so everyone can hear you?
Hi, Val Bassett, Prevention Strategies Consulting. I've worked for many years with Maddie, most recently at MPHA. I think the other piece of what you said, Maddie, is the insurers had bigger fish to fry in that bill. They were looking at possible rate setting, you know, there were possible caps on the size of reserves. There was, you know, I think one healthcare expert, financing expert, suggested tapping into reserves over a certain size to fund the trust. So, and they were under a lot of political pressure in this process too, for many reasons, you know. So it kind of behooves them to stand down a little bit. But I think an important thing to keep in mind is that won't necessarily be true in 4 years. Yep. This will be more isolated. So I'll come back to that later.
Did anyone else want to address anything you heard either at that time or since from insurers?
I think I don't know if you said this, but I was at a presentation with Commissioner Auerbach the other day, former commissioner, and I think he said at the beginning it was sort of in perpetuity that this trust would go on, and I think the fact that it got down to 4 years gave them that this was like a one-time deal for them, and our hope is that we can prove it's worthwhile for them to want to continue to fund this.
Denise Jolliker, University of Massachusetts Medical School, and full disclosure, we are a partner in one of the proposals that you'll be reviewing. But my question really is a broader one. How do you balance the clear need for data in this with the potential burden, or at least perception of burden, on the grantees for that data collection side of things when they want to do the work? And that's their concern.
So we're building our evaluation in right from the beginning, and we're actually hiring an outside evaluation contractor so that they can work with the vendors. And so a lot of the work we're going to be doing around the data, we provided all the data in the RFR for them so that they knew in their geographic area what their sort of baseline was. And so we're trying to keep the burden off the applicants.
We sort of again face a potential danger of the kind of health planning defaulting towards the clinical side, being kind of driven by hospital systems instead of governmental public health. So we're kind of facing a real imbalance, but this is like the mighty David, this little experiment, and kind of pushing against that, but collaboratively with healthcare systems as well. But one thing that I think is an important strength and capacity for public health in successfully if not being an equal player, being as close to that as possible. And so playing its leadership role is the translation work between the language of public health, the evidence, and the language of, you know, actuarial language and the, you know, the kind of insurer, the way hospitals and insurers make decisions. Now, the advisory board, the wellness advisory board, is sort of a microcosm of that in a little bit of a way. And I'm just curious for each of you how, but especially on the advisory board, but for each of you, how, what you're doing or what you see as important ways to further translation efforts, if you will, in both directions. So how to keep sharpening the edge of public health so that planning and reports and actual interventions are done more on that cutting edge of planning that incorporates preventable medical cause, you know, that sort of is intelligible to the healthcare world while staying true to effective public health interventions as far as possible, while at the same time educating those healthcare insurers and hospital systems on, you know, the envelope that public health is pushing, data are emerging, et cetera. Because I think, you know, when it comes to 4 years, and this is certainly true in Massachusetts, but it's true on a much larger scale around the country, that we kind of have to speak that language to kind of earn a place at the table as well as to maintain financing like this. So we sort of said, okay, we want to sort of get invested in this financing for good reason. You can't cut public health with one hand and pay, you know, 40% more for healthcare with the other. But on the other hand, we have to communicate well with good partners. So that was a long intro, but I'm just curious in each of your settings how you're finding working with those stakeholders, but also what this longer term strategy is to keep going in that direction.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, let me take a stab at, I guess, how I think about this, you know, the mid to longer term. I've had many interesting conversations with the CEO of Winchester Hospital, which is a very successful community hospital in my district. And, you know, he's a pretty forward-looking guy, and he always tells me how they really would like to do much more emphasis on community health. And they've had a community health institute for a long time, you know, and they really have trouble sort of finding any money to support that. Some of the programs they subsidize, some of them they just actually, you know, people pay to participate in these, all these different kind of local, you know, programs. And they want to really be able to do a lot more. So, you know, maybe my vision's a little different, but, you know, ultimately I think where I'd like to see us headed is that the $60 billion plus that's, you know, spent today in our healthcare sector, as we talked about earlier, a lot of that is actually providing healthcare to treat preventable conditions. You know, we'll, over time, that will, through, you know, payment reform and through the efforts we have to, you know, show the success of prevention and through various other initiatives we have ongoing, we'll start to shift that spending. So more and more of that $60 billion that's already being spent today, some of that's public money, some of that's private money, will be available to support, you know, population health, community health, prevention. So I'm not sure, to be honest, where that would leave, you know, something like this, which is a dedicated source of public funding. Hopefully, for the time being, we'll have both. But my vision, at least longer term, is that's where we will be able to fund all of these community initiatives.
A great question, Val. I believe that we were having at the department translational conversations in sort of three arenas, one in the department itself, who wasn't really used to evaluation, I would say, of the real metrics of healthcare, is that how many people have taken a program or participated in something was their idea of measuring success, to say someone had to really have health improvement and show cost savings and start talking about economics has been an interesting transition in the department, but I think that one that's really exciting because I think people see the opportunity to get public health resources for a long time if we can really do this well. I think at the community level and with many advocates that supported helping this happen, we had to change the conversation from primary prevention only to understanding that secondary prevention is still public health prevention, and many things we do in secondary prevention also are the same interventions for primary prevention, but we're really measuring what the secondary prevention outputs are. So kind of bringing them along that secondary prevention didn't mean they didn't get what they wanted in this particular bill, and in the bill told what the deliverable was around cost. So we had to keep going back to that because that was our vehicle to really demonstrate success. And I always say this is our opportunity to save. For every dollar spent, we can save seven. We got to show that we can really do that. And then with the providers, I think they probably still need the most work in terms of interpretation and the translation is that really what does population health management mean to them? And a couple weeks ago, we had our Ounce of Prevention conference here in Massachusetts, and Jeff Levy was there, and he, I thought, really focused on some interesting translation, and he was like, don't try to make the translation be one-to-one. Is it if they define population health management or call it something else, that we don't have to make them use our exact language to be talking about the same outcomes. And so I think sort of going to the table and giving some room for those who need some more of a learning curve is that we have to accept that as an opportunity. So
I would just say two things real quick to that question. One is, I think in the era of health reform and ACOs, we need to engage in the ROI conversation and learn how to be more savvy about and collect the data, but we should not have that be the only conversation. If all we're doing is going after ROI, I don't think we're doing our job in public health. There's a lot that's going to have a very long-term or a very difficult to measure ROI, and we still need to do that. This has to be one part of the conversation. And the only other thing I would say in terms of 4 years talking with the insurers or the hospitals about this, you know, we got this because we were organized as a public health community. And when we have that conversation in 4 years, if we're no longer organized, we're not going to get anything. So even though the campaign may be different, we have to continue to be organized. Otherwise, we will be the little guy in the room and, you know, we will be sort of told what to do as opposed to really wielding influence. And if we're going to continue to wield influence, we have to continue to be organized.
I see this as creating a model for how we can improve health, how we can link community and clinical care, and I think infectious diseases, I used to do HIV and AIDS work, I think they've always done the work at the community level, and now if we can figure out how to link them in a formal way to the system, where the system, through a global payment, will actually pay for some of that community-based work, that this is an opportunity. And that's why falls was really important to me, to not just have four chronic diseases so that we could show different conditions and different ways of saving money. I think we're talking about violence, domestic violence, adverse childhood experiences. I hope the sky's the limit after this.
Kathy Berg, Director of Government Affairs for the Health Officers Association of California. Is there one piece of advice you'd give to other states that are looking to
bill or implement into the health contract?
It's hard to figure out what the one piece of advice would be, but it's a great question. I mean, I think the thing that made this work, if you're going to look to this as a lesson, is to find the window of opportunity. You know, there's various things we worked on years and years and years and years unsuccessfully. We did this was, you know, the whole thing we talked about today was within the course of 3 years, but that was because we took advantage of a window of opportunity that we had. So I would say find what the window of opportunity is for the issue you're working on and take advantage of it.
Okay.